Welcome, everybody, to Leap Leaders Unplugged. This is Siobhan Neeland, your host for Leap Leaders Unplugged. And this is my special guest, Andrea, who is one of my mentors and one of my favorite people on the planet. So very excited to get to interview her today and talk about all the amazing things that she's done. So again, I'm Siobhan Neeland. I'm the CEO of Leap Ahead Talent Solutions, Leap to Success Executive Consulting. And we started Leap Leaders Unplugged to really uncover all these amazing leaders that I've had the opportunity to work with in my long, extensive career. And Andrea is actually, secretly, she's my mentor. She has been an amazing guiding light in the muckery of sometimes the corporate world. And she's really helped me sort of keep my true north of what's important, how to really be innovative in thinking through how to build out organizations, how to create change and still keep your integrity and your voice. So with that, Andrea, welcome. I'm so glad you're here. How are you today?
I'm awesome. Thank you. I'm so excited to be part of this magical series that you're building there. That's cool. Thank you.
Thanks. Yeah. So I was actually came to me a little bit after some discussions with you and I was like, I have so many amazing leaders that, you know, we talk behind the scenes and we talk about these things that we've done and then there's just, you know, there's no information out in the world about this. So I thought this would be a great one. So tell me a little bit.
It's all about storytelling at the end of the day, you know?
Yeah. Yeah.
Because we need to get our stories out there. We need to share our experiences in order to learn from each other. And, you know, we don't have enough people to share their stories, unfortunately. Well, those that we're not particularly interested in, that happens as well, right?
yes, right.
ours is interesting.
Yeah. You know, it is interesting. You start to see who gets elevated in telling their stories versus the ones that are behind the scenes. I feel like the majority of my work has been uncovering those gems that are out, heads down, doing the work, but not really necessarily getting the press for it. And they're the ones that are really moving the needle of change. And I feel like you're one of those people that really was silently moving things along in this extraordinary way. And you look back and go, oh my God, did she do all that? So I feel like I was always watching you and making sure I was paying attention to, and so want to elevate that story. So just a little disclosure. So Andre and I definitely used to work together at Amazon and AWS. And so with that, I'd love a little bit more about like, how we kind of worked together, what were some of those roles that you had, and then what are you doing now? How are things now? I know you've got some exciting work that you're doing and innovative work that you're doing. So tell me a little bit more about it.
Yeah, no, and I think we both met at Amazon and I had already, when we met, I think that was in 2016, I would say.
Yeah, a long time ago.
That was already my ninth year with Amazon. I had the pleasure to be on this roller coaster adventure ride called Amazon already as of 2007. And first in Europe and then in the US, always in HR. HR and people is my passion, and I think for a long time, the most undervalued and underestimated area in a business. Now we see the trend is shifting quite a bit the last 2 years. But I think that was always my passion and helping business leaders create successful organizations and structures and leaders to really take on the bigger roles to innovate, to do crazy things that nobody would have thought would be possible. And we did that at Amazon together on certain portions. We had the chance to work together on building Amazon Fresh as one of the very first grocery fresh produce delivery companies that were out there in the world. Now it's a it's a very normal thing for us. There's so many that were mushrooming left and right. But back in the days, we figured out how hard it is to do the business and what we can learn from it. And also had the pleasure of leading a team that was supporting all Amazon acquisitions and global expansion activities at Amazon, where I think one of the most exciting assignments that I ever had in my life to meet all these amazing people, all these amazing founders who had built their big companies. And now we made them part of the Amazon organization, and helping them through what seemed to be a pretty rough experience in so many ways, bringing their organizations on board, and also making sure that people understand that there is a true benefit to joining the larger organization, which has taught me a lot that I need today. Now, fast forward, I have left the corporate world. It's been a year almost that I decided I jump out of the corporate boat and will be adding value as an advisor to a number of companies that are mainly in the tech space. So software as a service is something that has always stayed with me due to the AWS times. And now I'm helping those companies to think differently about their people, their structure, their mechanisms, their way of scaling in the best possible way to be even more successful.
That's awesome. And you work now, you moved back from, I think when I met you, you worked in Seattle. Now you're living in Germany, correct?
Yes.
Are you predominantly working with smaller companies or larger companies in Europe or all over the world?
Those smaller companies also have a global footprint. So it's everything, basically. It's the entire world that we're covering, but those are originally European tech companies that I'm working with mostly.
What do you feel like is the difference a little bit from working with US-based versus European-based? Is there a difference in thought or innovation or anything?
I would probably say the biggest difference that I have seen, and I'm generalizing, obviously, because, you know, there's always exceptions to it. But I think the think big and bold element that founders in the US have that I was able to witness is at a different level than what you would find in Europe. And that's also has to do with how funding usually works in Europe versus the US. The US is a lot more like, let's go, let's get it done, let's get the money to grow fast. Whereas in Europe, there's a little bit more of a conservative view on the world of building companies. Yeah.
And do you feel like that also then plays into how you can be innovative, or especially around, you know, inclusion, diversity, equity, and belonging? Do you feel like those types, building out those mechanisms or programs, just come at a different pace than you do in the US?
I think it is a more prominent topic on the agenda of leaders in the US. And it has been for a much longer time. Mm-hmm. Whereas now in Europe also, with a lot more transparency around ESG goals, because that's the big thing in Europe, right? You also focus more on diversity and inclusion and making sure that you are actually broadening your view on what's your responsibility as a company. Mm-hmm. Because you are an employer, you're innovating, you're building great products that customers hopefully love, but you are also a good employer. And what does that entail, right? It's you want to create environments where people just love to work. They own their stuff, they own, you know, with everything that they have. And that includes also all kinds of people from all different kinds of backgrounds, from all different kinds of ways of thinking and looking at the world, which is now appreciated also a lot more in Europe.
We had been talking, I think last time we talked, you had talked a little bit about the shifts and changes. I think it's legal in how the legalities around ERGs and how that sort of was actually escalating and moving things a little quicker in Europe than it maybe had previously. Can you talk a little bit? I thought it was fascinating to hear sort of the difference, especially comparatively to the US versus most of the countries in Europe and where they're going with that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, sure. I mean, the ESG law in Europe, which...
And ESG stands for, just in case anybody doesn't know.
You're complying to certain standards on the environment, the social and the governmental compliance elements. That's what ESG stands for. And I think environment has already been a lot more prominent with sustainability and everything on companies' agendas. The government aspect is something where you say, yeah, I know that's something that we have to do. We have to be compliant. We have to respect local laws. We need to get ahead of it. The social aspect of it is something that was probably not on companies' radar that much, to say we also play a big role in creating social equality or a standard, or even getting ahead of it to really raise the bar on our social responsibility that we have.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that started about a year ago, started this sort of shift where there was push to do this and having more companies had to be more accountable for their sort of rating, I think, isn't it, for this particular?
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it depends on the industry and the size of the company. But if you're a publicly listed company in Europe, you have to comply with certain standards. You also have to report this in your annual report on your non-financial results. And that's basically what ESG goals are about. If you're producing, you have to create a lot more transparency around where did the ingredients come from, what are the different supply chains you are leveraging, under which circumstances did you leverage the supply chain, which then comes to making sure that you can trace back the roots of the supplies that you're using, so that wherever you get, you know, your different products and your parts, that it has nothing to do with child labor or forced modern slavery. Those kinds of things now need to be traced as part of the law that was established in Europe. It's called the Supply Chain Act.
I think it's really interesting that there's that movement in that, where I find you and I had also discussed a little bit about, I think that there's this interesting backlash in the last year and a half. You know, during the pandemic, there was this really rise in inclusion, diversity, equity, and belonging work. And really, like, I know Amazon invested enormously in building out diversity teams. I think you and I partnered on a few of those things while we were there, and just these robust programs to sort of building out these kinds of environmental, social programs, all the different ways that we could support not only our employees, but our customers in those ways. But what I found is there's this huge backlash. I think the average is 40 to 50% of chief diversity officers have been let go in the U.S., in the last year and a half. I don't know, I haven't looked at the stat recently, but last I looked, it was between 40 to 50% diversity teams, you know, DEI. I always call it inclusion, diversity, equity, belonging. I always put the inclusion first, but DEI is what it's usually called. Those programs are being chopped. Most of my diversity mentors or professionals that I partner with are really, you know, their budgets have gotten cut where they can no longer come in and help with programs, or the divisions themselves have been cut within the companies. And I think it's just as interesting. And, you know, I don't think it's a long-term thing, but I do see this, you know, there was all this, everybody wanted to build out their diversity, inclusion, equity, and belonging, become the employer of choice. And then whatever happened last year with this shift in the economy, the shift in layoffs, the shift in all, you know, the markets have all changed quite radically. All of a sudden, all the diversity budgets, inclusion, diversity, belonging, creating ERGs, all of those things in the US have really dried up. And there's less community, and there's almost a backlash about talking about diversity, equity, and belonging. Are you finding that as well in Europe right now?
I mean, it's hard to generalize. And I think what you're talking about is probably more prominent in the younger companies, in the more dynamic companies. The large corporations have not been cutting their budgets on DE&I as much. Because there is this responsibility that those big companies have, and they also know that it's a long process. If you start certain D&I initiatives today, you might see some effect only in a couple of years from now. And if you're stopping it now, that means you are creating a gap for a number of years. The smaller companies, when they had to, especially starting in 22, I guess, with all the big layoffs that we saw, especially in the tech industry, everybody was quite conservative when it came to their budgets. Because let's face it, a lot of the companies were not used to operating with profitable growth in their minds. They were all for growth, growth, growth. Let's get the people in. Let's make sure that, you know, we're an attractive employer. And one ingredient to becoming an attractive employer was the DE&I initiatives. Now, I'm not saying that I agree with the approach of cutting in particular that budget, but I think it's an easy budget for them to cut in a way, where they're not clear about the consequences that this might have. Yeah. And that it's actually a competitive advantage if you didn't cut it.
Yeah. I feel like the areas that I saw the cuts were diversity, equity, belonging, leadership training, leadership education, and management training, which really impacts a company so much. Yeah. And then also their talent, like their top tier talent acquisition, started only hiring, you know, younger junior people. And so those three things do seem like on a long term, now companies are starting to suffer from that a little bit. They're having, you know, attrition. They're not having as much of that cultural people feeling good about the company that they're in. Or I do see that kind of thing happening, but I don't see the companies moving quickly back to bringing these budgets back or to adjusting them. What's your take on that?
I see the world of talent really being like, when it works, it's a nice flywheel where everything kind of fits into each other and it kind of propels and makes things better. And especially the cuts that you were mentioning are such disruption to this talent flywheel that when then everything is becoming turbulent, it gets hard to really get back into that rhythm. And I'm concerned that in 3 or 4 years from now, we will see the outcome of it.
Yeah, that's what I think. I think it's still hard to see it, but the backlash from all of these huge cuts in industry trends around creating a really robust talent machine, you know, which the people were really starting to build those innovative mechanisms, both small companies and large companies. And all of a sudden, everybody, it was became contagious. They started laying off, cutting out budgets, and everybody started, even if they didn't really need to, everybody's like, well, they're doing it, maybe I should do it. And and I started to see this epidemic in a sense of that. And I think you're not really going to see the results of all that till 2025, 2026, where everybody starts to think, oh, well, maybe an AI recruiter is not the best thing in getting more diversity or getting a more inclusive or emotionally intelligent hire. Mm-hmm. So what are your takes on some of that?
I think if I, if I put myself into the shoes of, you know, a founder of a tech company and the leadership team, I know I usually have a number of investors that I also have to keep in mind when making executive decisions. Mm-hmm. And sometimes those cuts that I'm making are not necessarily my choice, but is something that will help me in the short term. And I think that comes back to a little bit of what I see, and I actually tend to criticize mostly for private equity companies, to say you are still not focusing enough on the people side of things in your portfolio companies. What you're looking at when you're investing is only scratching the surface of people. And we have seen in 2022, these cuts that were made is that the decisions that were made on the people side were probably not in line with the growth of the business. Mm-hmm. So the people growth was ahead of the business growth. And then everybody was screaming about, oh, we need to grow more profitably. We cannot go so crazy on the investments that we're making. And I agree. But what we're also seeing now is we're going back into old habits. Now there is a little bit more investment on the table again, and we're making the same mistakes. We're hiring people again, but not really thinking about the longer term implications. What are we doing with the people? We need to grow. Okay, let's bring the salespeople in. But the product team is not even ready to kind of keep the salespeople busy. And I'm advocating for more thoughtful leadership because that's also something, if I'm probably a little bit more conservative on the people side and I'm more thoughtful and I'm anticipating that there is certain effects that my decisions have on the growth that I'm seeing, that would make companies a lot more productive and would also therefore make them scale better. And I think it's the responsibility of the investors to also look more deeply into this.
I totally agree. I feel like I come in and through my Leap Ahead Talent Solutions, I come in and evaluate companies and look at their talent in all the different ways, not just the hiring, but looking at like, what are their 10-year goals? Like, where are you? And are you actually hiring for what you really need? And that's what I almost always, I'd say about 75% of the time, people just go higher, but they don't look at actually what they need. They don't look at what they actually have. And then their leadership development, they haven't trained their leaders how to hire. They haven't actually trained their leaders how to manage correctly for where they want to go with these goals and intentions. And then they also haven't really looked at the inclusion, diversity, equity, and belonging, which isn't just about diversity. Yes, you need diverse voices, but it's really, have you created an ecosystem, an environment where people are so excited to come to work and create new products for their customers that they're engaged with each other and empowering each other? And then the customers are so excited to buy the products because it just sort of radiates out. But you really have to evaluate. And what I see almost always, even with just being, when I was just a recruiter, I would stop most of the people and say, you think you want this software engineer? You don't. You think you need 100 software engineers? You don't. You need actually a team of this, and this. Like, and then we'd reorganize. You know, that was part of what we had to do with Fresh. We had to really look at, everybody was like, oh, we just need 100 more engineers. No, you don't. And thinking through the longer term, where do we really want to go? What do we really need to get that? And throwing bodies at it, or just throwing a bunch of leaders who aren't actually trained to think through and how to hire. I mean, those kinds of simple things, those mechanisms have changed the dynamics and have really saved the companies that I work with or the divisions that I work with. Millions of dollars, right? They either drives their revenue and then it helps with attrition and then it helps create productivity and, you know, makes our customers happy, you know? These are those simple things. I feel like we had built some innovative mechanisms in as we were building out both Prime Now and Fresh. What are some of those things that you feel like you've learned from both that and also the work that you're doing? Like, what is something that either a smaller like C-suite company could, there's executive team could look at and go, okay, here, let's reevaluate so they could do some self-assessments about how to build their organization. What is your take on that?
I mean, I come back to the same word, being thoughtful about what you want to do and what you want your teams to achieve. I think the majority is really busy working on the task at hand and accomplishing the goals that were set. But it does not necessarily always leave time to think and to find solutions that people haven't been thinking about before, or maybe even completely new ideas. But you need the headspace. So as a leader, what I have been working on with one of my teams was to talk about what does think big mean as one of the Amazon principles that I still truly believe in. It's thinking really out of the box, being open, being somebody who owns not only the task at hand, but also far beyond, to say, and we are running this with a lot of passion and we will come up with solutions to problems that nobody has even been thinking about. But now that we're finding a solution, people say, huh, obvious, right? And there's certain mechanisms that you can put in place to give your team members the headspace to allow themselves to think about it. So one of them was to really inspire each other with storytelling, so that we invited great leaders to share their stories about how they have solved the big problem or how they thought out of the box, but also giving my team members minimum 1 week a year to really use this for their personal development, for their learning. And the only requirement was that you needed to report out to the rest of the team about the great things you have learned and how you have grown in that week, that would not have been possible with, you know, if you would not have had that really uninterrupted time to think about it.
That's awesome. I do. There's study after study shows when you give people that freedom or that, and that layer of mentorship, education, freedom of personal and leadership development, it's exponential in how that helps. I know that when we were facilitating a lot of really intensive diversity or leadership skill sets, workshops for like, you know, it would be like almost a week of in depth. You know, challenging like where your habits and challenging those things. Those hiring managers that I worked with, those leaders that I worked with after that were really like different people.
Yeah.
They really thought differently about how they hired. They looked at their longer term goals. They also, you know, told me that they ended up having better relationships with their family. You know, like it was all inclusive in that kind of thing. And I think I think most of us women know that that emotional intelligence piece, the ROI on that is so exponential. And I think we still live in a culture that just goes, well, that's a little out there. Let's get some data. But that, you know, I mean, just like they study kids in school, like learning, you know, music or art, they tend to do better than in math, right? I think these kinds of things, really doing that personal development and really honing that's where that inclusivity and belonging becomes part of, actually, this is how you make better leaders. This is how you make better employees, you know, and better people when you kind of give them those tools. Yeah. Did you say
it's also the trust element to it, right? Because I think it's like we had all these discussions during COVID. Can we trust our people that they're working remotely from somewhere I don't know? And then of course we can trust them because we didn't have a choice. But now that we can make choices and potentially bring people back into the offices, now we don't trust them that much anymore. Did we really have good data around how productive, more productive, less productive we were in the last 2 years? To me, that's something where I still cannot wrap my head around to say, okay, we were on such a good path. I understand why certain topics or tasks should better be done together. I think inspiring each other on solving big problems or having big ideas usually comes when you work with people in the same room. But it doesn't mean that I expect you to be there 3 days a week, right? It has to do with trust. It also has to do with ownership of each and everyone. If I don't get trusted by my manager, I don't know. I also need to look at how I am contributing, how transparent I am to contribute to the goals, and not just blaming the manager, oh, you don't trust me, right?
Yeah, I think you bring up a really good point around when I feel I have freedom, I will go above and beyond. When I feel like I have that autonomy to go, and if we're hiring the right, if we're hiring real, true, top tier performers for the roles, if we really look at the criteria of what we want, most people are looking to do that. They're willing to go above and beyond, whether they're working from their home, their kitchen table, wherever they are in the world, or if they're coming to an office. If you give them that freedom, it was the rare people that weren't doing the work, right? That to me was a bad hire, was people didn't actually vet them for their actual skill sets. They were vetting them based on a degree or vetting them on something else besides actually looking at, like, you can kind of tell if you ask the right interviewing questions whether this is the type of person that you can trust. But to just blanketly not trust anybody to work remote, I think study after study has shown that actually people were much more productive when they felt like they had a sense of quality of life and balance in their life. They could spend more time with their children and their families. All of a sudden, they were performing better. That, you know, I think you're right. They sort of got amnesia and forgot about that the last 2 years. So one of the things I also wanted to ask was, did you notice when you added and implemented these leadership development programs, the more storytelling, did you notice a revenue increase with the organization or any particular upticks in output in any particular way?
I mean, I had the pleasure of working in highly innovative and kind of fast scaling teams where you usually gather highly motivated people per se. Mm-hmm. And you also have leaders that tend to be very inspiring. But you also need to make sure that, you know, people find their channels to still think out of the box or think differently, while at the same time allowing them to also get fair and honest feedback. My experience as an HR leader for those teams has always been, if you understand the business, if you understand the team dynamics and the priorities, if you have a good view on people, bring it together and use it for you as potentially your superpower. Because there isn't that many in an organization who have, speaking of diversity, this diverse perspective. Because usually the majority is in a tunnel, working, getting things done, doing great stuff, right? But you come in and your role is to provide a different perspective and to ask the questions, but also to share your observations. That was always a huge eye-opener to people that, you know, my team and I had the pleasure to work with, because that's what you want. You want people who tell you the truth.
Yeah, it becomes so empowering and inspiring when you have that kind of transparency and people can see the vulnerability, and then it gives you the room to go grow and change as both an individual and an organization. Yeah.
And those folks also become a lot more authentic. Mm. At the end of the day, what differentiates a leader from another is authenticity, from my point of view.
Yeah, I agree.
Successful leaders, they're successful in playing a role, but you can only play a role for so long, and you can only go that far. Mm-hmm. But what makes a real difference is authenticity.
Yeah, I agree. And accountability, like authenticity around, you know, here's what mine is, here's your part, here's how, what do you need from me? Like having that open, engaging relationship. Yeah, authenticity is really probably, I agree, is probably the number one ingredient that makes me feel safe, as, you know, when I'm following too, right? I want to know you're not going to march me down the wrong path, that, you know, I can trust you. You'll be accountable for what's going on, and give feedback.
So I give you an example from my earlier days on how I learned how to leverage the power of authenticity with my team. I had the opportunity to attend a leadership training where you got a lot of great feedback. You had coaches who helped you in really observing you in a different way. And they had, and they gave me the feedback that I have to use my power very carefully in how I come across, because I can come across as very convincing. And even on topics, I'm not. And as a leader, that can send the wrong signals, because it can shut down your team to not have a good discussion with you about what is the best solution. But you're so convincing that they say, okay, if she thinks that this is the right thing to do, we do it. Mm. So I said, how can I approach this and kind of make sure that we're still making the best decisions? And how can I find people that help me to get over this? So what I did is I shared my feedback with my team. I came back from the training and I shared the feedback with my team. And I said, listen, if I ever come across too confident, as too convinced about a topic, I ask you to challenge me. Challenge the heck out of the conversation. And if I'm still convinced, you can be sure that it's probably the way to go. But if you ever hold back because you think I'm too convincing or I'm too sure about how it comes across, that will not work well. And so I invited them to challenge me a lot more, and that has created so many great processes and things that we have done together, where at first they were shocked how authentic and vulnerable I was. There were so many other development areas, I wouldn't believe it, but that's one of them. But that was something where I will now always start with, when I introduce myself to a new team and we talk about what is typical for me, what they should know, that's one of the things.
I love that. That's really powerful. And then what a great fertile ground to grow from, so that then you really are in partnership with your team instead of dictating. I love that. And that just says, you know, it's why I've always admired you so much, that you always bring that vulnerability and innovative ideas around that. You know, we're kind of getting close towards time here. Was there anything that you feel like, any story you want to end with, or any thoughts that you want to leave people with?
I think what is exciting, and I speak for obviously my beloved people function, I think what is exciting is now finally the realization that people topics are probably the most important topics that we are confronted with on a daily basis. So that also means for our function, we need to up our game. We need to be really strategically getting ahead of where we need to be in order to make sure that the businesses can make the right decisions. Because we're the ones who usually look around three corners, not just one. And so we need to help the businesses to anticipate what's ahead. In these times, even more so with all the uncertainty and craziness around us, we need to be there as probably the strongest partner to our businesses.
I couldn't agree more. I think talent, people, anything around that, it's evolving and shifting and morphing so quickly, and people are becoming more conscious of what they need and don't need. I do think that we have it, like, there's almost more importance than there ever was, where I feel like HR was kind of, oh, it's just this thing. And now it's becoming, it has to be, you know, I've been sitting as a chief talent officer in companies, whereas before that was always much a subservient role where we were still more kind of like below HR. And the VP of HR was still not quite always up at the C-suite. And I think now they're starting to see more and more of those titles where you're really seeing, you have to add that voice up at the top of your C-suite. I think if you can, to be able to navigate this next stage of what's happening, because I don't think, I've personally never seen anything quite like what's happening in the market around talent and people management and leadership development. It's in a diversity. It's like, it's all radically changing right now. And I think it'll be really interesting to see how companies, you know, I think it'll make or break companies on how they bring in people like you and myself to be those advisors for them. And I think that's a really great call out.
And not just coming from the typical, oh, let us coach whatever the leadership team, right? I think there's a good reason for all those amazing coaches to support the companies. But I think what matters even more so these days is to look at the people side from a business strategy point of view. And building that bridge between business and people is something that is usually underdeveloped in a lot of companies. So, but where you talk, right?
Yeah, I feel like most people look at just hiring the people like little widgets. And what I see when I look at an organization is I see the infrastructure, the foundation of the house. Do you have, and I think, this became so ingrained. I think working with somewhere like Amazon and AWS, you really learn about, like, you and I have both used the word mechanisms already several times on this podcast. Like, so these frameworks and mechanisms about how you actually build your talent so that you're just not throwing a bunch of people on top of it. And I think really having a plan and infrastructure and optimized talent framework is sort of what we focus on in the work I do, that you can then build and scale and you can go up and down with ease and your team knows how to go with ease. And it isn't really just about the people anymore. It's about this mechanism that really is in alignment with the goals of this, of the C-suite, of the, goals of the company.
Exactly.
But, yeah. Well, as always, you're one of my favorite people on the planet. And I know we're like 8-hour difference. So I appreciate you at the end of your day coming to meet me in the morning here. And we'll hopefully have you back on and I'll talk about some more things. I know you and I have talked a little bit more about building out interview trainings and bias trainings, and I'd love to have your experience on that in the future and in a future podcast. But anyway, thank you, Ms. Andrea, and thanks for all your wisdom. And we're now going to say goodbye.
Bye, everyone. Bye, Siobhan. Thank you.
Bye. Bye. We'll